curiosity leads to engagement, innovation, creativity, empathy. You list it. Everything that they're having problems with, communication and turnover. There isn't anything that I've found that doesn't start with curiosity.
Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, an exploration of the idea of curiosity and its increasing importance for thriving in the digital age from the authors of The Curious Advantage.
Hello and welcome to this episode of The Curious Advantage podcast. My name is Simon Brown. I'm one of the co-authors of the book The Curious Advantage, and today I'm here with my co-author, Garrick Jones.
Hi there.
Unfortunately, Paul can't be with us today. We're delighted, though, to be joined by Dr. Diane Hamilton. Hi, Diane.
Hi, I'm so excited to be back. I love coming on to your show because you guys found the subject that I care about most, so this will be fun.
Oh, welcome back. I think you're our first returning guest as well, so it's great to have you back for a second time.
I love it.
So you're the founder and CEO of Tanera, a consultancy business. You're also a keynote speaker. You have your own radio show, and you're author of 6 books, including the newly released Curiosity Unleashed, Achieving Business Excellence by Challenging the Status Quo. So maybe kick us off. Can you give us a reminder of your journey and how you ended up where you are today?
Well, you know, I've done a lot of things that made me more curious as I got older. I think a lot of the jobs I've had made me scratch my head and wonder why people weren't more curious. And as I started to interview people, like you guys were great guests on my show, and I've had a lot of people I've interviewed, thousands actually, I started to notice that a lot of them were more curious than I'd like to have seen in some of the students, because I teach for a lot of different universities still. And I thought, well, what's different about these people? And it made me really recognize the value of curiosity, which I had always been pretty curious. And I thought, well, why aren't other people curious? And that's led me down a rabbit hole of really interesting things that led to my work. So that's kind of the story.
I know that rabbit hole, there's some great models and great examples and things that we've talked about before. So maybe let's start with your latest book. So not content with 5 books, you've written the 6th, Curiosity Unleashed. That builds on a lot of your previous work. So previous book that we talked about last time was Cracking the Curiosity Code. And I have used the FATE model from that on many times. And maybe we'll do a reminder in a bit for our listeners around that one as well. But what are the new insights and the surprising things that you've learned about curiosity in your latest book and through the process of writing the book?
Well, you know, I never thought I was going to write another book. I did write a chapter for a book on curiosity from a group called Thinkers 50 out of London. And I did a chapter, but not an entire book. And after I wrote the first book, Cracking the Curiosity Code, I just learned so much that I hadn't recognized prior to writing that book. So I started speaking to groups so much about different things that weren't in the book. People started asking me, What have you seen in this respect, or what are companies doing? And then I'd go to different companies and help them, and then I'd learn new things. And I thought, well, this needs to be an entirely new book, because I kept getting questions about the financial connection between developing curiosity and the outcomes and things like that. And not just like, it's good to read a book or it's nice to learn a new topic about something. I mean, that's great for the sake of curiosity. But what I was focusing on was really what I meant by curiosity. And it took me a while to really define it in my mind, even after the book came out. And I started to think it really was about getting out of status quo thinking. And it's about doing things differently than what you've done in the past, because what worked in the past doesn't always work in the future. I mean, if you asked Kodak that, they might tell you they agree with you, right? So it's just something that I found interesting was so many people were holding on to their glory days of what worked, and they just kept repeating it over and over again. And it worked great in the past, and they were frustrated by why aren't we getting somewhere now? And so I did a lot of research into organizations that held on to status quo thinking and those that did not. And I looked at people who did and did not. And that's what this book was more about. Instead of just talking about, writing about the value of curiosity, which it's there, I made it much more specific as to what happens to you if you embrace it, what happens to you if you don't, and the financial benefits of creating a culture that embraces curiosity, which I know you have done with your work, Simon. And I think it's really so important that companies do that. And I'm just so surprised by the companies either who don't do it or they do it and we never get to hear about their results. And that's what I want to know, are the results out there? And I'd like to see more companies share them.
Absolutely. Yep. So I love that. So the definition you're using is sort of getting out of status quo thinking. So we talk about an attitude of wonder with a spirit of exploration. So that exploration, I guess, is similarly getting out of that sort of status quo thinking. And interestingly, we've asked many of our guests on the podcast, you know, what's their definition of curiosity? And we've had pretty wide variety. So everyone has same sort of theme, but definitely sort of some broad definitions. So,
anyone else said status quo? I like status quo sounds better, the English version. But it's status here. But have you had anybody say that? Because that's really... or do they just use different terms for it?
I think it was John Hagel talked about curiosity and learning in the context of not learning existing things, but learning new things. So I guess that's sort of, not learning the status quo, but learning things that haven't previously existed. I know, Garrick, you can think of some other ones as well that...
Well, I think about Warren Berger. You know, what Warren makes us think about, what are the questions you're asking in this context? And he talks about how dangerous it is to ask the same questions in a new context if you haven't appreciated. You can't use, which I think is what you're saying about status quo, it's dangerous to use your old ways of thinking in a new situation, thinking the same outcomes are going to apply.
You know, it's interesting. I just speak to women's groups sometimes, and when I do, I add a slide to my slides that it was from Fortune. They did a survey of all the CEOs that were women that have been successful and ask them what led to their success. And I list a lot of them on there. I mean, they're like IBM and big names. And I add a couple. I add Oprah and I add Mae Jemison, since she, did so much with NASA. But I think that what was interesting to me is if you ask them what led to your success, whether they use the word curiosity or not, it just varies a little bit. Some of them use different versions, like asking questions, exploring, and like you said, but they all credited this, not all, everybody on the list, but a lot of them credited curiosity or some version of curiosity as what led to their success.
Yeah. Well, you've got this focus on the individuals and highly curious individuals in your book, which I found fascinating. And you've mentioned, Oprah and Mae Jemison, and you also, people like Warren Buffett, Elon Musk, Albert Einstein. I just saw a fantastic Instagram with Warren Buffett talking about his partner. The two of them were like a unit who worked together for 50 years. And he talks about how the interaction between each other challenged each other to kind of look outside of what other people were looking at. Can you tell us a little bit more about this idea about highly curious individuals and what is behind it, do you think? We know they're successful. What gets them there?
It's interesting because you mentioned a lot of the people I wrote about in the book, and Warren Buffett always mentions how much curiosity was so important to him, and you can see him talk about that. He's got a book in his hand all half the time, and he shares that with a lot of people. And then I listed a lot of people that I thought, maybe controversial, like some people don't love Elon Musk, but I thought he was important to add because it did lead to his success. And a lot of, I don't know if you've read Walter Isaacson's book on him, but it was a really great look at the kinds of things he did that demonstrated his curiosity. He didn't just put parts in because everybody put those parts in. He made sure they were, first of all, needed for physics. You need this part for sure. But he was known for saying, no, the best part is no part, because we got to know whether we need this part or even why it's required. So he went down and this list of reasons of why we need this. And if it's important, we keep it. If it's not, we see if we don't need it. And I think that what was interesting is like you said, why do some of these people hold on to their curiosity and why don't they? I read the book I Was by Wozniak of Apple, and he, I think, kept his curiosity because of his influence from his father. He writes a lot about how his father would bring home different gadgets from work and wires and teach him about how this wire is needed because it brings electricity, or this is required because you need this. And he taught him how to really build basically computers later, right? So it ties into my work with the factors that inhibit curiosity. Now, one of the factors is your environment, your family, friends, whoever you've ever interacted with in your life, whomever. And with him, that interaction actually was a positive influence for him, because he had a positive family member to help him keep his curiosity. So there is the good side of some of these factors that inhibit curiosity if we've had a positive influence in that respect. And I think Wozniak's a great example of that.
So maybe diving into the sort of steering away from the status quo. So maybe can you share why it's so important to not embrace the status quo? Why, you know, if companies find a model that works, they shouldn't just, you know, keep doing more of the same thing?
Well, you know, in the United States, I'm not even sure if all of the company examples I listed in the book are in Europe and elsewhere, but Kodak, obviously, a lot of people are aware of, and we have, you know, Netflix. There's so many. Netflix took over for Blockbuster, I should say. Blockbuster was a big company that rented the video. And so there's a lot of these companies that we look at in the past and we go, well, wow, they just seem like they would never not be there. You'd walk into a pharmacy here and you'd get hit by Kodak film. It was everywhere. And so I think there's so many examples of companies that were just so successful that they thought they were too big to fail. They thought whatever they did would be the Midas touch because it worked so great in the past. And we know with AI now coming to be so strong that everything's going to be upheaved because it's just so different of a market. And I used to sell computers in the 80s, and we used to just talk to people and people would freak out. Computers are coming. It's going to take your job. All these bad things are going to happen. And some jobs, of course, were lost. And then some were replaced with other things. I mean, we have social media managers now. We didn't know we were going to have social media. You know, we have all these new jobs that AI can take over for some of them, but then we'll have new jobs that it won't. So I think it's really important for companies to really look at how they can utilize new technologies and consider building a culture of curiosity that embraces this. Because if you hang on to what worked in the past, it's probably not going to work in the future, because the future is in a whole new context, as you said before, that Warren had said, that you can't keep thinking that you're in a vacuum because everything around you is changing. So with the famous, you know, you just have a faster horse comment from Ford, that if you ask people what they want. So sometimes you don't know what you want until you start exploring and asking questions. And I think a lot of it depends on learning more about AI and its capabilities. And I know you guys have done some, I loved your interview where you interviewed, was it ChatGPT?
Yes.
One of the AI
Yeah, it was ChatGPT. Yeah.
It was a great one. I hope people
Yeah, we loved that too.
It's really interesting because I love it because it does a lot of things to help my day, you know, be more efficient. But I actually did a research study recently where I gave it the data because I thought, well, this will be so nice if it does the statistics for me, because I don't love doing factor analysis and whatever, you know, correlation analysis. And so I thought, well, correlation analysis is easy. It's a computer. You just put it in. It's like a calculator. And it did not do at all what I asked it to do. In fact, you know, I had 51 C-suite executives in my study asking them, you know, what was your financial impact of creating a culture of curiosity? And it kept coming back with, here's what 250 of them said. And yeah. I'm thinking, this is a problem. And if I didn't pay attention to that, I argued with it for a long time to try and get it to do what I wanted. And it just wouldn't do it because there's something missing that it needed for it to give you the output you wanted. And I don't know if a lot of people are realizing that it can't do everything it thinks it can do. So we have to have people do the things it can't do, and eventually it'll do more things, but we have to be curious to recognize that.
It's a tool. It's a tool. You can't use a hammer to screw in a nail, you know, those kinds of things.
But I thought it would be more like a calculator, you know? How can a calculator is going to give you, for math, I thought math is a no-brainer. It's going to give me...
Math is one it's still struggling a bit with.
Yeah, it is. That surprised me.
And we have in our disease model the criticality piece. So criticality, I think, in the age of AI is becoming absolutely crucial that, what seems like it might be true, what looks like a great answer from ChatGPT or other large language models, we need that critical thinking.
If it looks too good to be true, it's usually filling in what you want. It wants you to think so that it looks better. It tries to make you look good, which is kind of nice, but it's not helpful. And so I think it's, you know, I'm part of a group that's associated with Executive Networks, which is a big company here that is all the CHROs are part of. And I think that's how I found you originally, Simon, through that group. But I took one of their courses recently, which was really interesting about getting certified to, I have a certification to ask the right questions to get what you want, to get the prompting correct, to get the AI to give you what you want. And I thought that was really fascinating. I think we all could benefit from doing that.
Yeah, I actually did one earlier today, which is a Coursera course on using Gen AI as your thought partner. And so that's great as it's sort of, prompting you with ideas, with challenges, with questions, and providing that role. You still need the criticality element on what it's telling you, but it's very powerful at being a sort of thought partner on ideas. Yeah,
it definitely helps to know how to do that.
Yeah. Staying on the sort of getting away from the status quo. So using some of the examples that you referenced there, I mean, Kodak, so the classic one where they invented the digital camera but then weren't able to actually sort of utilize it. So what stops people from getting away from the status quo, or what keeps people in the comfort zone that they sort of know and recognize?
Well, you know, with Kodak, they didn't want to cannibalize their product. And they thought if they did this, then, you know, they're going to lose all that. But they're going to lose all that anyway because somebody else is going to cannibalize their product. So I think it's recognizing your culture is stuck and that other people have passed you like you're standing still. And I think, you know, in the past, we didn't see how fast things could change. And now we do know, and we have case studies like Kodak's and Blockbusters. And there's companies that really question, do we need to put this to rest? Ben and Jerry's I used as an example in the book, and they make ice cream, and they actually give their products a burial. They have a website with little headstones, and they say, this was a great flavor from this time to this time, but we realize that we're not doing that anymore because you guys don't want that. And you can't force feed people ice cream they don't want, right? So they learn that, and they're very innovative in that respect. I mean, just from one suggestion on a board of asking for flavor suggestions, they came up with chocolate chip cookie dough ice cream. I mean, the amount of chocolate chip cookie dough they sell now is staggering just from asking one question. So I think there's a lot of great examples of companies where they realize that they don't know everything. We can get some feedback from other people and get some insights, and what worked in the past doesn't always work in the future.
I've got so many things I want to ask you about, Diane. I mean, the first thing, it reminds me of the great futurologist, Chris Meyer, who talked to us about ants and termites and talked about from the Big Bang to the Big Mac, where he said when ants have evolved to the point where they always have a main source of food, but they also always have small trails going out looking for other forms of food, like a Big Mac. If your Big Mac gets washed away, you need to have something else to keep the hive alive. And it's the same with curiosity, though, that idea of we need to be always out there being curious about things out of the status quo, I believe, to have the things that allow us to pivot. And as you say, to have the other things in place that will allow us to stay relevant in the market and so on. This leads me to the idea of finance. The thing I loved about your book is you get into the financial value of curiosity really, really quickly. And it's such an important point. I mean, as you know, we talk about the greatest driver of value in the digital age is curiosity. And people go, oh, that's great, fantastic. We have a lot of qualitative, you know, reasons to back that up. But we're also looking for financial reasons or quantitative reasons to back that up. I believe that there are vast numbers of quantitative reasons. There's a huge amount of financial value to having options to pivot to and so on, because you're going to keep your business alive. But it's early days, isn't it, in the kind of how do we put a number on the value and what are the tools we use to do that?
Right. Well, you know, I want to touch on, before I answer that, what you said before about ants, because I had a whole part of the book about biomimicry. And I think a lot of what we've created is just based on nature and some of these unbelievable solutions to things. I think it was slime mold. I included in the book how to do roadways and different things from following its paths and what's most efficient. So part of being successful and being curious is looking at what has nature done to make this happen. But as far as the financial question, that was the one that drove me the most crazy. And another time I argued with Chad, because she would just say, or I say it's she, because it has a name of a female underneath it, but I'm going to say it's a she.
She told us she was she in our interview.
So she was a she? Okay.
Yeah.
So she argued with me quite a bit that, you know, it's intuitive that curiosity ties into financial benefits. And I said, well, give me the data. Show me what the studies were. Let me know what the, you know, I want you to tell me how engagement, proving engagement has saved this company XYZ dollars. And it's because they had a curiosity initiative. Those were the kinds of things I wanted to give me. And I gave up because she didn't have it. And there really isn't a lot of data. And I know, Simon, you did some of this research in your past company. And I don't know what you think about this, but do you think companies are sharing that kind of data? Should they share that? Can they share that kind of data? And what have you seen in that respect?
Yeah, so we were able to look at examples of, I guess, new products that came about that were driven by curiosity. So, you know, that two people were curious around what would happen if they linked their research together and knew were there things that could benefit each other from it. And that curiosity then led on to, in that instance, new medicines, which, you know, then have vast value and impact on people's lives as well. So you could certainly trace back, you know, this product would not be in existence if it was not for the curiosity of these two people who wanted to explore and were curious about what happened if they linked their two bits of research together. That way you can attribute that value to curiosity. But I think sort of being able to say curiosity drives, you know, directly this value is a harder one to go up from curiosity versus back from something that could be attributed to curiosity.
Well, what I've been working with companies is that what I'd like to see is companies giving something like Kashin's, you know, measuring your level of curiosity, tells you, are you high, are you low, kind of get a baseline, whatever you want. You can create your own if you've, you know, whatever you're trying to establish. And then do curiosity-based training and then get people to, like when I train them, I get them over the four factors that inhibit curiosity. And then I, again, want them to measure their curiosity levels later and then correlate that, like you did, I know, Simon, with engagement. Or, you know, you can measure engagement, you can measure different things, whether they use Gallup or whatever way they measure these things. And I think it's really important because I talked to you a little before the show. I had done some recent research looking at the financial benefits. I haven't published it yet, working on that. But what I asked is I went to the C-suite and I asked them, are you seeing financial benefits with engagement and turnover and different aspects of what they're seeing? And if you're having a culture of curiosity, has it been financially beneficial to you? And they all were giving me such this unbelievable feedback. I kind of didn't expect it to be quite as positive because I didn't know that so many people were doing these initiatives. And I was really glad to hear that. But the smaller companies would say they'd saved at least 100,000 in the last year from doing an initiatives. And then the larger companies would save at least $1 million a year. And I thought this was great feedback. And I thought, this is what I want to see. I want to see companies publish that they move the needle on engagement, they move the needle on innovation. And this is the financial benefit we receive from that. And you're just not seeing companies publish these results. And I think it's so important to get that out there in the literature so that other people are aware that if we do this, we're going to have bottom line benefits. Because curiosity leads to engagement, innovation, creativity, empathy. You list it. Everything that they're having problems with, communication and turnover. There isn't anything that I've found that doesn't start with curiosity. And so they see the value of it. And I was really happy to see a lot of these responses saw the value of it. But I don't know that they're sharing that value. And I don't know exactly what initiatives that they're taking. But to me, if you want to build a culture of curiosity, you have to find out what's keeping people from being curious. And that's what my research found.
We'll come on in a moment to that one as well. On the value of it, we had Spencer Harrison on from INSEAD on a few episodes back, and he shared that he was doing some long-term research looking at the curiosity of the CEO and advisors to the CEO and sort of those around them, and then correlating that to the sort of long-term performance of the organization. And That research was ongoing, but at the point he was indicating, it was sort of pointing towards this correlation between the level of curiosity at the top of the organization and then the long-term business success of the company. So that was reassuring that at least that was also backing that up at an overall sort of macro level. So
I'd love to see it when it comes out. Tag me. I want to see it.
Do you think much has happened, Diane, from before we last spoke, which was about a year or so, maybe a bit more ago? I mean, curiosity seems to be much more on the agenda now. Do you think it's becoming mainstream, if you like, in terms of companies who are serious about digital and just having to shift and change have to put curiosity into the mix?
That's a good question, because, you know, when I wrote my book so many years ago, I had set up a Google alert to tell me anytime that there was an article on, or study done on curiosity. And then I had to take minus Mars rover out because I got my email blew up. But back then, I didn't get many responses. Every once in a while, somebody would mention the word curiosity, but a lot of it was kid related. It wasn't in the workplace. It was just kind of general stuff. And as after my book came out, I started getting more and more and more and more and more. And now it's coming up constantly. And I love that everybody's jumping on board, because I think I want everybody talking about this. I want everybody writing books about this. I want everybody having podcasts about this, because I think it solves so many problems that a lot of people didn't recognize were tied to that. And I think we never needed it more than we need it now with AI, because AI has its own kind of curiosity, and it's that which was interesting. And I think that we need to know how to see where our value is with a world that has AI that has its own kind of curiosity.
Because it seems so limited. We thought AI opens up the infinite, but it actually, we're learning about the limitations of the language models and so on. And then we're also, as you were saying, learning how to engage with it and ask the right questions and to get the kind of outcomes that we're looking for. We're all learning together. Can you talk a little bit more? I mean, your research is so great around the things that stop us or inhibit us from being curious. Can you remind us again about your fake bottle and so on?
Well, you know, I want to add the one thing on the curiosity, if on the AI thing, because they have developed an artificial curiosity in that when they had computers playing Mario Brothers, they would find that the computer wanted to find out what the next level was so bad it would allow itself to die to see what would happen if that happened, right?
Wow. So,
we got some competition here, is my point, is there is this level of curiosity with AI. But as far as my research, I think that the most important thing that I did was I was frustrated by the fact that nobody was looking at what was inhibiting curiosity. Because to fix something, you have to figure out what stops it, right? And if you don't know what the problem is, how do you fix it? So I studied thousands of people for years and came up with the Curiosity Code Index, which is an assessment that determines these factors that inhibit curiosity. And the four factors are fear, assumptions, which is the voice in your head, basically, technology, which is over and under utilization of it, and environment, which was everybody with whom we've ever interacted. which was interesting to me because I expected a very heavy percentage of people being influenced more by fear and maybe less by technology or less by whatever. And they were very similar in how much they impacted us. And fear did not surprise me at all. Nobody wants to ask questions in meetings or look stupid and, you know, and have that sense of not looking prepared or whatever it is that people fear. But the assumptions make a lot of sense because we tell ourselves this isn't going to be interesting. They're just going to give me more work. Whatever it is that we tell ourselves can definitely inhibit us. But technology surprised me at the time. I remember thinking, huh, hadn't thought about that. And the people who take the assessment sometimes think, oh, well, I'm good at technology. I'm going to do okay on this. And then they find out that they don't do as well because sometimes it's over or under utilization of it. And we can rely so much on it that if I relied on ChatGPT's telling me my 250 people did so great, I would have been in big trouble because that wasn't really accurate, right? So we have to know the foundation behind things, and we have to know whether what we're getting is accurate information. And then we could have low tech and high tech days. Okay, so we all catch up about all the stuff that we're behind on. And then once we are, we know how to use it as best that we can. So the people who are surprised usually are people who just love the technology but don't know the foundation behind it maybe. But it's a combination. And then environment didn't surprise me at all because that was a big one for me because, you know, we have siblings, we have teachers, we have people maybe with good intentions who say things that could inadvertently inhibit us. And sometimes teachers can't answer all our questions or, you know, siblings can be ruthless. They'll say, you don't like that, do you? That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard of. And then you go, you don't want to upset the apple cart. So you try to get along. And there's a lot of things that leaders and don't recognize in the workplace that it's maybe not them that people are inhibited by, but their past leader, their past coworker, their past social media. I mean, there's just everything that could inhibit people. So for me, when I train organizations, we go through and touch on all these factors and do kind of a personal SWOT analysis to overcome these threats and weaknesses. And then we create SMART goals and an action plan to overcome all these factors. And then the other half of the training, which is really interesting because I'm developing a training program right now in Luxembourg. I'm going for Fulbright as a part of a training I'm doing there. But what I incorporate in the second half of my training is how do we fix all these issues that leaders have already told us are the problems? Plus, do you agree that these are our problems? What other problems would you like to add to this list? And then you get the employees giving you from their perspective, this is how you would fix these problems by building curiosity. So it's kind of like taking a page out of Disney's book who went to their employees that were having high turnover and asked them, how can we make your job better? And they saved $100,000 just from, you know, asking a simple question that you go to the horse's mouth, you find out what the problem is. It's great for leaders because they get this, you know, compiled version of all the answers for them. It's great for the trainer because they look like a genius because they came up with all this stuff. And so we get all these answers and it's all up to the leaders, which ones, of course, they can implement and what they decide.
You use a term in your book called artificial curiosity. What do you mean by artificial curiosity? How does that relate to artificial intelligence or ChatGPT and all the other things that are going on? But artificial curiosity is brilliant term.
Well, you know, I had people on my show years ago talking about this, and it goes back to that Mario Brothers experiment. And that's what they were referring to, I think, when they talk about artificial curiosity, is that the computer actually becomes curious by wanting to figure out an outcome. And it is like the way people think in some respects, because it wants to know what's on the next level. And so that is artificial curiosity. And you don't think that AI is doing these things that are kind of human-centric. But there are aspects that you go, well, this is going to be interesting where this goes. Because, you know, I had the father of AI on my show at one time. And he's like, oh, yeah, computers, everything's going to take over. We're going to be gone. And like,
great.
We're talking with Dr. Diane Hamilton. She's the founder and CEO of Tonera, a consulting and media-based business. She's a keynote speaker, and she has a US nationally syndicated radio show that's called Take the Lead. She's also the former MBA program chair at the Forbes School of Business, listed by Leaders Hum in their 200 biggest voices in leadership, and also in their top 10 most powerful women leaders in HR. Diane's also authored multiple books which are required in universities around the world, including, so we've referenced the Cracking the Curiosity Code, but also The Power of Perception, and then her newly released book, go check it out, which is Curiosity Unleashed, Achieving Business Excellence by Challenging the Status Quo. So in the latest book, Dan, you also talk about companies that are starting to get it right around curiosity, and you cite several examples. So what are these companies that are leaders in encouraging curiosity doing?
Well, you worked for one of them. I thought they did a great job at Novartis because of the culture that they rewarded learning. They had Curiosity Month. They did a lot of amazing things. And I'm sure you've covered that a lot on the show, so I'll pick a different choice. But I did some work with Verizon, the wireless carrier here in the United States, and I liked what they did. They had me come out and create videos for their onboarding process. And I would speak a couple minutes about the value of curiosity and what, you know, why it was so important. And then they would take examples of employees who were highly curious and share their journey of why this had made them successful to be curious and how it led to their current position. And these were pretty short videos, in all maybe 5 minutes or something. And they ran them throughout all their stores, throughout all their onboarding, throughout all their intranet to share, like, look at what happens. This is what we value. We want you to be curious and look at, you will be successful. And we want this in our new hires. And I love that because I think, you know, I've had companies that really shared their culture and mission and values with me. One made me memorize it and be on videotape. It had to say it word for word. It was 3 pages. That was hard to memorize. But I think this really shares that this is the value of what we get from this. And I've seen a lot of companies. I mean, whether I've worked with different companies throughout, a lot of them in the U.S., you know, I've spoken with and had them take the Curiosity Code Index. And they all have a sense that this is the need that we have for the future of this company to remain competitive. And whether I'm working with companies like LinkedIn or Entrepreneurs Organization, I mean, from all realms that I've spoken with and had them take this assessment, I've found that they each do something a little bit different. I don't think that there's one right thing to do. I think it's based on your culture. I think it's based on what you're trying to achieve. I think it's where you are now compared to where you could be. You can't go big if you're little. You have to start in increment baby steps sometimes. And so, you know, not every company has the resources that a big pharma company has to do what you guys did. So I think it's really individual, but I think doing little videos, doing things like that are a good basic first step that could lead to the next step. And I liked another thing that they did at Novartis with the, like, I call them mini TED Talks, where you had the employees share something that they learned. And I think that those kinds of things don't cost a lot of money. Those kinds of things, you can get your employees, instead of hiring people like us to come in, you get your employees to share something that they've learned. No better way to learn something than to teach it. So I think that there's a lot of initiatives that I would like more companies to share again. Everybody's keeping all this stuff to themselves. That's really great stuff. I mean, I had Xander Lurie on my show from SurveyMonkey, and they really did a lot of different things. They had skip level meetings. They had all these different things to encourage people to share ideas. And I think that every company has a lot to share if they've encouraged a culture of curiosity. Because even I was surprised by my study that all these companies were saying, yeah, we're doing all this with curiosity, because I'm not seeing a lot of that being reported in the literature.
I love that. And you're right, it's different by different companies as to, you know, what works. But I think showing that this is what we value and showing that this is how people have progressed in the organization using that Verizon example, I think is so powerful that everything is geared up then around, you know, we're going to reward those who are curious that they will progress more in the organization. And that's what we value as an organization. So, yeah, it's great to see.
No, I agree. I just wish that more people would share what they're doing. And I hope they do.
I wonder, what are you personally most curious about right now?
Well, right now, I think it's ChatGPT. It's just so fascinating to me. I mean, I know there's other platforms, but I guess I got sucked into that one a lot because it's just so amazing to me that it can, you put in something that would take me a month to read and it reads it in 1 second. And it's just the sheer speed of what it can do is really fascinating to me. You can learn so many things if it's accurate. See, the accuracy is what I'm probably most interested in, is how accurate is this? And if it's not, I guess the certification training I took said, I'm trying to remember because I had to take a test on it. It was like 65% accurate unless you prompted it properly. And then it got up to like 85%. And then if you asked it to check itself, is that accurate information? Then it got up to 90% according to the certification training I took, but you had to make sure you jumped through the hoops to get to that. And I think that learning about that is really important, especially if we're going to start incorporating some of this, which I think we'll see a lot more of it in the business setting. And we need to know what it can do, what it's good at, what it's not good at, and why.
So we're coming close to time. So we covered a lot. So we've heard about your new book, Curiosity Unleashed. We heard what inspired you to get into curiosity around wondering why some people were more curious than others. We've heard about your first book, Cracking the Curiosity Code. We've talked about the financial connection, your definition of curiosity, so defined as getting out of the state of status quo thinking. We heard why that's so important, but also why that's so hard. We heard how several people that you cited, of Oprah and Mae Jameson and various others, that it was actually curiosity that was one of the key things they attribute their success to, including the likes of Warren Buffett, of why curiosity is so important for him, and also even the likes of Elon Musk as well. We heard why we shouldn't embrace the status quo, yet how we should be utilising new technology, also how the things that get in the way. So fate of fear, our assumptions, our technology and our environment. We heard how we can get stuck in our culture. And then we have why it's so hard to attribute financial value to curiosity, and some great discussions around there. How curiosity can solve so many of our problems. And then into artificial intelligence, artificial curiosity, how AI can be curious. And how you're currently curious, as I think Argaric and myself, around where's AI going to go and what's next with the ChatGPT and what's going to happen when 5 comes out, which is rumoured in the not too distant future. So out of all of that, what would be the takeaway for our listeners? What would you leave as your parting thought for them, Dan?
Well, I'm also curious of why AI can't seem to draw letters properly, but
yes.
I'm like, what's this? What happened to all the words? But I think that the key takeaway is to recognize that it's important to just look at what you're doing and realize you don't know some of the things you don't know. And getting mentorship can be helpful. Having people around you to give you a reality check that maybe you should look here or look there because you've just entrenched yourself so much in the status quo. I think it's just taking that kind of analysis of what is inhibiting you from your own perspective. How is fear? How is assumptions, technology, and environment? How are those things impacting you? And kind of do a personal SWOT of your own and just think about how to overcome some of those threats and weaknesses. And if you can create some goals for yourself for some of those things, but really get an outside perspective. It's so much easier for somebody else to point out some stuff. And we have to have a little bit thicker skin and realize that 360s are important. When I had Daniel Goleman on my show, you know, he was very much into the value of a 360 evaluation for emotional intelligence, because curiosity is like emotional intelligence. Those people who need it aren't going to pick up the book to read about it, right? So we need them to get this outside perspective. And sometimes it's helping to get this great mentorship. I've been involved in so many companies that I've been a mentor or I'm on mentor groups. And I think it's just so critical to help everybody else. And I hope more people serve as mentors and get mentors.
So if you haven't got a mentor, then maybe start thinking about who could be your mentor and who can help in guiding, you know, what do you know, what you don't know. I remember when we had Brian Murphy on, he talked about hold lightly onto what we believe to be true.
And I think, great.
A mentor can be great at what actually is true, what do we believe, and where do we need to revisit what we know. So Diane, as before, I mean, a fantastic conversation. So a huge thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. I always have such great conversations with you guys. This is wonderful.
I loved it.
Thank you, Diane. Always a pleasure.
You've been listening to Curious Advantage podcast. We're curious to hear from you. If you think there's something useful or valuable from this conversation, then please do write a review for the podcast on your preferred channel saying why this was so and what you've learned from it. And don't forget to give us a 5-star rating. We always appreciate hearing our listeners' thoughts and having a curious conversation, so use the hashtag Curious Advantage. Curious Advantage book is available on Amazon worldwide. Order your physical, digital, or audiobook copy now to further explore our 7Cs model for being more curious. Subscribe to the podcast today and follow the Curious Advantage on LinkedIn, YouTube, and keep exploring curiously. Thank you very much. See you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Curious Advantage podcast. The Curious Advantage book is now available to purchase on Amazon. Stay tuned for the next episode and keep exploring curiously. This podcast is produced by Aliki Palinelli and John McGinty and edited by Jill Damatak-Futter.